I'm very, very proud to welcome a wonderful artist to Crossover this week. Her name is Tessa Suter. Tessa, welcome to WRTI.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, you're a discovery of not only by me, but by the jazz people here at the station. They had talked about this album. They said, Jill, you really have to talk to Tessa. And I kind of said, oh, okay, you know, classical, you know, things that have been turned into pop tunes. That's happened before. It never happened like this before, though, I have to say. It's a wonderful album. Beyond the Blue.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
What I really wanted to say is that music written without words comes alive with the right words. And that's what happened here. I mean, I actually, there was one piece that I liked it with my favorite, the Prelude in E Minor by Chopin. The yeah. lyric was so great, I said, I really like it with a lyric, you know. So,
oh, well, that's actually the first one that came to me, funnily enough.
Well,
pick that one out.
Well, your whole background, though, is rather fascinating. You're from London, is that right?
Yes.
And you have an interesting, they said you're Anglo-Trinidadian.
My father was from Trinidad.
I see. But when you came to the States, you went to San Francisco, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, that's where I first arrived in New York, and then I went for a holiday for 1 week to San Francisco. And as San Francisco has a way of doing, it kind of got its claws in me, and I never left. Stayed there 4 years.
It's beautiful there. But you went there as a writer, is that right?
I did, yes. I was a journalist then for various publications in the UK mostly, and then actually also in America as time went by.
But when did you start singing?
Well, I started singing actually when I was very young. When I was about, I remember my mother taught me a kind of a Jim Reeves song about a man trying to persuade a woman to have an affair with him. And I was about 3. So I've sang always. And then when I was about 12, my mother decided she was going to learn to play the guitar. So there was just one in the house. And of course, my mum, she's a bit like that, picks things up and puts them down. So I saw the guitar and I picked it up and I taught myself to play the guitar. And I accompanied myself singing folk songs influenced by people like Sandy Denny and Pentangle and Fairport Convention.
But you never really studied music formally?
Not really. I mean, I did go to Manhattan School of Music, actually, for one semester.
Okay.
But I wanted to go there to learn theory, but that wasn't offered in the semester that I ended up going into the spring semester instead of the fall. So I would have had to have done theory and piano too. And since I was completely remedial in theory, I couldn't do two. So I have to wait until next year to be able to do any theory. And since that's why kind of I had gone in the first place, I left after I met Mark Murphy.
Yes. Well, that changed your life?
It did, actually, yeah, kind of. It did, actually, yeah.
They said he was your mentor.
He was my mentor, and he was just fantastic. It was it was 4 years. So I feel like I went to the University of Mark Murphy. It was really great.
You got your Masters of Murphy, I guess.
Yeah, I got my Masters in Murphy. Yes, because you're right. I already have my undergrad from London.
I don't know if it gets better as the degrees get higher, but
go for my doctorate next.
Well, I wish you luck. I was very surprised, I have to say. Your album was recommended to me by Jeff Dupron and Bob Craig here at the station. We are a dual format here, classical and jazz. And I said, oh, okay, here we have these things that have been done and redone, and some of the songs I even remember. What is so great about this? And I have to say, the lyrics, and of course, you have some of the most outstanding musicians on the planet.
Certainly do. Yes. Amazing, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just listened. Some of them, the Debussy, the My Reverie, was an old tune.
Yes.
Yeah. And what was
Larry Clinton put the lyric to that.
Very, very old. And my favorite one, as I said, though, was the Chopin, though. I just thought that I loved it with the lyrics. You're a writer, but very poetic in terms of what you're saying in these lyrics?
Well, I did write, I mean, I wrote poetry when I was from as far back as I can remember. I mean, even when I was sort of 7 or 8 and all the teachers would cluster about my parents when they came in and say how great I was at poems. I had my first poem published when I was about 11. And I definitely didn't think of my, well, in fact, shall I say my only poem published. I never really thought of myself as that, but I have written songs, quite a few songs from, you know, when I was about 18, I suppose. And I guess the lyrics are kind of a bit poetic in that they are slightly, they're never obvious. And I think poems are like that. You could put many interpretations on most poems that I think. And I like my lyrics to be a bit like that too. I want people to have their own interpretation.
You know, the Aranjuez, you know, from the Rodrigo.
Yeah.
You know the story of that. He wrote that when he was on his honeymoon, I believe, with his wife. And the castle, Aranjuez, was this old, old castle. But your lyrics really feel like that once upon a time thing. I mean, you really do have the feel in that one. It's quite beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, that was actually another one I wrote a long time ago. 2001, I wrote that.
So actually, when did you really start writing, I mean, the lyric? When did you start singing and when did you start writing the lyrics?
Well, let's see. I started singing, I suppose you could say professionally, in 1999 when I came to New York. I'd been here about 2 years. And I sort of fell into getting a gig at this bar downtown, or cafe kind of, called Cafe San Marco. It's not there anymore, in the Village, opposite the Village Vanguard. Mm-hmm. And I did that every week for about 5 months. And I suppose it was, and before that I'd been doing open mic sessions at this place called Cleopatra's Needle, also in New York.
Yes.
And I suppose it gradually, after doing this gig for 5 months, I gradually sort of built up a mailing list of people. And then gigs kind of, I mean, I would ask somebody for a gig once, and if they said yes, great. And I would then, once I'd been in there, they usually would have me back. So I guess my career, if you like, started out like that and just gradually kind of snowballed.
Well, obviously it did. But now how many, this is not your first album, though, is it?
No, this is my fourth album. I can't believe how lucky I am to be able to make so many. No, my first album was Listen, Love. My second was Nights of Key Largo. My third was Obsession, which was my debut for the label that put this one out in the US. And this is my fourth one, which is actually put out by the same label in Japan that put out Nights of Key Largo, as well as by Motema here.
Now, when you perform, what about the musicians? Who do you perform with? I mean, do you travel in an ensemble, or do you pick up great, great artists at jam? I mean, how does that work when you?
Yeah, sometimes occasionally you get to travel with amazing people. Like, I actually did do a gig with Steve Kuhn. It was amazing.
I wanted to ask you about him too. He's a Steinway artist, is that right?
Yes, he is.
He's really kind of amazing, amazing, really.
But his playing is so sort of appropriate, isn't it, somehow? It sort of fits with being a Steinway artist.
Well, he's just talented. I mean, but it's a different genre, of course. And that particular one that you did with him, the Baubles, Bangles, and Beads, I love that. You sound so happy.
Oh, well, I am happy. Yes, I was very happy. Because that's the thing, when I'm singing anything, I have to be able to mean it or have experienced it at some time so that I can sort of get into it, you know.
But it struck me. I mean, you have a lovely, lovely voice, but it struck me the words, the way you said them, there was joy in them, you know, like, oh, baubles, bangles, and beads, you know, I just love all these lovely things to wear. And you were just swinging with everybody. It was really marvelous.
Oh, thank you.
I read somewhere that the 4A elegy you had written, well, there were some very interesting things that happened with the instrumentation, because there was an accordion in that one, which somehow when I hear accordion, I think French, but... You know, this
yes,
was.
Yes, it's funny that, isn't it?
It does. It's strange. But this was, you said this had happened, you wrote it after the tsunami in Japan?
It was because we recorded it about a week or two after the tsunami. And we were all surprised, actually, that it went ahead because Mr. Hara, who is the co-producer with Todd Barkin, had flown in from Tokyo and was on the phone every day constantly to his wife and daughters, finding out how everything was. And so it was, you know, very shocking. And I was doing a lot of this material right up until the last minute because I'm a sort of deadline person. I need a deadline, and then I sort of start working like a week before the deadline, practically. So I hadn't actually written a lyric to this one, even in the studio. I actually larred it, may I say. And when and in the week between that and going in to, you know, do little fixes and stuff, I wrote this lyric for Japan. And I found the title kind of just very evocative. The original title is Elegy. And I thought, oh, I wonder what that sounds like, you know, while I was trawling about on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And I saw this beautiful version by Julian Lloyd Webber, just solo cello.
Oh, my.
And I thought, yeah, I think I can do that. And I wrote the song, and it was sort of slow in my interpretation. But when Mr. Hara heard it, because he was so emotional at the time, he sped up quite a lot of the songs, and it actually worked, I think. He said, no, too sad. And initially, he couldn't even cope with the accordion. He thought the accordion was too sad too. But so we were thrilled that he left all that in. But yeah, so that's kind of how I did it. And it's sort of, I don't know. I mean, I wanted to write something that's positive. Of course, you can't really be that positive about, for some of the people that had the terrible experience, but some of them hopefully would, you know, be able to identify with that, looking to a new day.
Well, I tell you, though, your words are, I said poetic already, but they're really fresh. I mean, it adds an enormous amount to the beautiful melodies. I mean, you have gorgeous music, classical music here that is, you know, part of repertoire and has been played and replayed so many times. But this is a whole new look, and I think that's what's so exciting about the album. I mean, initially somebody said to me, well, you know, this is a singer who took some classical stuff and, you know. Well, it's not that at all. It's you've redone them in a way. I mean, you really bring them alive on another level. And I think that's a tribute not only to your singing, but to your writing. And without waxing too poetic here, you have marvelous, marvelous musicians with you.
Oh, yeah.
And
absolutely.
And who was responsible for getting them together to work with you?
Well, I had the CD. It sort of came about because I heard Steve Kuhn's beautiful Pavan for a Dead Princess. I don't know if you know that album.
Oh, the River.
Yeah.
I don't know his album, no.
Oh, well, that you'd love. It's all classical repertoire. I think all. Anyway, that song I heard just on its own somewhere, and I was like, what is this marvelous song?
Oh, well, that's Ravel. That's the one.
Yes, and he made it just sound so incredible. So I wrote to Mr. Hara because I needed some new CDs and wanted him to send me some more product, as they say. And I happened to just mention that I'd just been listening to Steve Kuhn's album, which was put out by Venus. And he wrote back and said, oh, you've just given me the idea for your next Venus CD, which is classical repertoire with your lyrics. Because he knew I wrote lyrics because I'd written lyrics to a lot of instrumental jazz music prior. Mm-hmm. And he said, with the Steve Kuhn Trio. And I was like, oh, my goodness. I just couldn't believe my luck. Exactly. And by the way,
My goodness.
That was amazing. And then I'd just seen actually Joe Locke at Dizzy's, I think. And he's just such a fun, I mean, he's a wonderful player, very sensitive, very evocative and fun. So I thought, you know, I'd like vibes on this. And so I asked for Joe Locke, and then Mr. Hara wanted some extra musicians, so we had
David Fink, incidentally.
Yes. Well, David Fink is also part of that trio.
Oh, I see. Okay.
There's a long-standing 20-year trio, I think, with David, Steve and Billy. So Billy Drummond,
that's, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So so that was sort of a more of an obvious thing. And then
Joel Fromm,
who's
fabulous. Just fabulous.
Better all the time. I mean, in fact, they all do. It's
really something. I mean, what happens is you really, it's an ensemble performance, really, with you as part of it. And that's what you feel. And then on top of it all, the lyric. And I have to congratulate you on that.
Thank you very much.
Because what you did is something very different. You're taking material that has been used and played and replayed and over and over and over again. And in a mediocre way and many times, or just classical, and you've really turned it into something unique. And I congratulate you on that. And I don't get excited about things a lot, but congratulations on this.
Thank you.
Now you've got quite a busy schedule. You're going to Rochester, is that right?
Yes,
I'm going. To the Jazz Festival there?
Yeah, this will be my third time there. I love Rochester. So I'm going to the Rochester Jazz Festival. And then I have also a gig at this concert series called the Marblehead Jazz Concert Series.
Yeah, in Massachusetts. Uh-huh.
Yeah, in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And then I'm a bit later in the year, I'm traveling to California. I should be going to the Bach Dancing and Dynamite Society, which is great, on December the 2nd. Actually, it's quite a way off. And, you know, just a few other places.
I read somewhere that you regularly perform in Russia.
Yes. I say regularly, about once a year. Yeah.
Well, that's pretty regular. How are you received?
Yeah. Oh, they're fantastic Russians. I mean, my goodness, what an audience. You play to these concert halls, and they are just such passionate, educated listeners, because, of course, the level of education and cultural education in Russia is surprisingly, I suppose, or perhaps not surprisingly, it's amazing. So people come to the concert sort of knowing what to expect. The very first concert I had there, I actually did a version of Cream's White Room. And just almost as soon as I started, the audience started applauding because they knew it already, because that was freedom music to them, music that they weren't allowed to listen to, 17 years ago, whatever. And they, the women are just very passionate, and they usually come backstage and they cry, and the men are all, you know, boisterous and happy, and it's wonderful. I love performing in Russia. In fact, in the streets, Russian people aren't terribly friendly, but in concerts, or when you meet them one on one, you couldn't get a friendlier people, it seems to me.
Well, it's also the kind of music that you're bringing them. And where do you perform in Russia? In Moscow or around the, you know, other areas?
Well, my first performance was in Moscow, the Moscow International Performing Arts Center, but mostly since then, I've been performing in Siberia, of all places.
Yes, I've heard about jazz in Siberia, by the way.
It's huge.
Yeah.
You know, who would think that you'd get sort of 1,500 people to come out in 10-foot snow to hear jazz, but they do. That's when they go out, actually, in the winter, I suppose, because there's not much else to do. And if you can make it outside, you've got to do something thrilling. Or,
well, jazz is very big in Russia, and it's very big in Europe. I remember when I was in Prague, there were so many jazz clubs and so many people playing. But Russia is very much, whether they're discovering it, for the first time, or it's a different style of jazz than they know. It has become something very, very in there, I think.
Yes, you're right. There's a lot of jazz performers going to Russia, I see.
I just, once again, Tessa, I hope, will you be coming to Philadelphia? I know you were here at Chris's.
I was at Chris's. Mm-hmm. And I've been a couple of times, I think, to the Philadelphia Art Museum, which I always love too.
Oh, that's a wonderful venue to perform in.
It really is, because everyone's so happy, it seems, always at that venue.
The environment. It's very beautiful, too.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. And they'll sit on the stairs.
Yes,
and
it's open.
Yeah.
It's very elegant. Yeah. Now, I just quickly, you wrote a book?
Oh, yes, I did.
In your spare time?
Yes, in my spare time. I don't think I could make time for a book now, but I wrote a book called Anything I Can Do, You Can Do Better, on which Random House Vermilion Press published in 2006 in the UK. And that's sort of about, I mean, it is about how people can change their lives and become something that they maybe always dreamed of being. Like I dreamed always as a child of growing up and being a singer. And I kind of held on to that dream throughout my teens and 20s and 30s. And now here I am. And I interviewed a lot of people from the book who done the similar things. Like actually a very dear friend of mine became a novelist, very successful, won the Carnegie Medal and Smarties Award and Branford Boas Award for various novels. And he was a plumber until he was about 60. So,
well, you have to have courage.
It does take courage because you've got to keep going and you've got to get, I mean, I did a workshop once where I was, it was called a Blocksbuster workshop. And I remember one of the women there was so critical about her own work. And I said, well, you know, if you've got to get over yourself, you can't, if you're going to be like that, you're never going to write anything. You can't, you've got to say, look, I'm just going to write it and see what happens. And that's how I do everything, I think. I don't come in with strict ideas about how it's going to be, or I just let the thing itself kind of take over, like the book almost wrote itself, songs write themselves, if you let them, kind of.
So yeah, I think you have to allow yourself freedom. Yeah, you have to forgive yourself.
Exactly, yeah. You have to forgive yourself, but it does take quite a bit of courage put yourself out. I mean, I feel like with this CD too, that here's something, all the lyrics are super personal. They all have a particular meaning for me. And so you're kind of almost laying yourself out bare and saying, here I am, this is me. Much more than songs that I always want to mean everything I sing, but you can slightly hide behind somebody else's lyric and kind of pretend that maybe it's not about you. But this feels much more naked.
Well, it's also the rhythm of your lyrics. You know, it's like writing music.
Yes. Well, I think a lot of the greatest writers, James Joyce, Anthony Burgess, all these people were musicians. And I think even the writers who are wonderful, who aren't musicians, maybe they could have been musicians. They just didn't ever find out. You know, there was no piano in the house or nobody encouraged them or something, because everything to me is about rhythm. Absolutely,
yes,
everything.
It is.
In life.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that somebody who's musical would write, I think, and vice versa, probably.
Yeah, I think
maybe.
So. But to put it together, it requires, I mean, this really was, I keep repeating myself, the words were very meaningful. The melodies were very moving, and the marriage of the two is very powerful, and I think you came up with a winner, so.
Oh, thank you so
congratulations.
Much.
Congratulations. I look forward to, I hope we'll hear you again somewhere here in Philadelphia, and I guess another album pretty soon.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, this one's only just come out here, May it came out, so, but I've got ideas for the next one. I have already.
And no more books?
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I did have an idea of writing a book that would be a sort of continuation of the other one, kind of a bit even more practical, a bit of a, okay, here, why don't you get together with a friend and spot each other? But I don't know if I just, it's a lot of work. Writing a book, yes, was so time consuming.
Well, you also have a very full career now with this, I would imagine, and other projects. So again, thank you for giving us the time. Really a pleasure, and certainly a unique album, Beyond the Blue, with Tessa Suter. And thanks again, Tessa.
Thank you, Jill. Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye.
Bye.